Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and I'm here with a bunch of people, and we're all here interviewing the one and only Werner Herzog. Thanks for coming here today.
Appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate to be in Washington, D.C. Haven't been here for a while, and I find it an impressive place.
Yeah. When was the last time you were here?
About 2 years ago. Unfortunately, never really long time, maximum something like 3 days. I've never really stayed here for more time, and in a way, it's not right. I should be here more time and longer time.
Well, we're excited to have you here at AFI Docs. I'm sure everyone would agree. Tonight's the Guggenheim Symposium. You're a fascinating person to have for this because, unlike some of the previous years where they're just strictly documentary, you sort of cross both narrative fiction and documentary. Aguirre, Wrath of God, and Fitzcarraldo have sort of that doc sort of style, even though they're fiction films. But then you got Grizzly Man and Lo and Behold. What's your take on the lines being blurred between the two? Are they just different extensions of the same medium to you?
Well, it's all movies for me. That's as simple as that. But of course, for me, the line is not that clear, and it's in a way blurred. There's casting, for example, and you see it in Lo and Behold. It's very well cast. And I do the same thing in other documentaries, and I stylize my documentaries, and I become inventive sometimes, but for the sake of looking into a deeper, more illuminating truth. So I've called it an ecstasy of truth, an ecstatic truth. And I think much of what you are seeing today in documentaries is an extension of journalism. And I think we should divorce ourselves. A part of documentary filmmaking should be divorced from journalism.
More of a subjective take?
No, it should not be so completely fact-based. Facts do not illuminate you per se. In other words, the phone directory of Manhattan, 4 million entries would be and all of them factually correct, would be the book of books, but it is not. It doesn't illuminate you. And I'm just saying that because I think in documentary filmmaking, we should look beyond what is a factual and beyond what is a journalistic quest for something like investigative journalism. That's what you see quite often. Totally okay, but it belongs more to television and it's a part of journalism. I try to divorce myself from it.
Awesome. There's the next documentary, The Phone Book. Werner Herzog reads The Phone Book.
No, not really. I'm actually finishing right now a film on volcanoes, and I've seen very, very strange, unusual places. I filmed in North Korea, among all places, which is totally unusual, and everything is different there than for us. Very fascinating, and in Africa, in Ethiopia, and recently Indonesia, and Vanuatu Archipelago in the Pacific. So I just follow my fascinations, and I'm still trying to be a good soldier of cinema.
Awesome. Go ahead, again.
I've noticed that your film makes a nice companion piece. I'm sure the festival organizers thought about this a little bit with Zero Days, Alex Gibney's movie about cyber warfare and how new and a human experience this is, how we don't have norms for it. We're going in a direction that few people understand. And that seems to be a nice companion to Lo and Behold.
I must say I do not know about this film. It's the first time I hear about it. But of course, yes, the festival has more knowledge about what's going on at the moment.
My question is Do you feel, and I'll see the movie tonight at the symposium, but do you feel that as a human culture that we are approaching some sort of strange tipping point without regard to taking a step back and really thinking about where we're going?
Yes, and for that, Lo and Behold is an ideal sort of piece to watch. I'm personally somebody who doesn't use cell phones, for example. Not because I'm nostalgic. I do not use it for cultural reasons. I do not want to be available all the time. I do not want to examine the world through applications on my cell phone. And by the way, when you speak about cyber warfare, I do not want any hacker, whether it be a private person or a government agency, to know all the time where I am and how many minutes at what time I'm calling whom and I receive calls. Nobody can track me down unless you have somebody sniffing around in this hotel and finding room 411 and checking out, yes, I'm sitting here with you.
You mentioned
you can't because I don't have a cell phone.
Right. Similarly, you said you didn't want to have a cell phone, so you don't want to look at it through these applications. Do you think that the internet interferes with our capacity for joy at all?
Not necessarily. I think we can derive a lot of joy through the internet and through our cell phones, but ultimately we have to create a filter. And we don't have a clear idea what the filter and how it should be. How would we limit our time on cell phones? What would we exactly do with our cell phones or our internet connections? Mm-hmm. I use the internet via my laptop, for example, but very limited. I use it for emails. Sometimes when it comes to family on another continent, I do Skype, and sometimes I look at Google Maps. So, but that's basically it. Mm-hmm. And I do not use a cell phone. Mm-hmm. So I know exactly why I don't want it. Mm-hmm. And many people do not have this kind of filter. And we are losing, for example, the capacity of conceptual deeper thinking, because we delegate the examination of the world to our applications, and that's it. I give you an example. One of my editors has a girlfriend who visited him literally every day by car in Los Angeles, and she's only a mile and a half away. Only three turns left or right. Very simple. She always was on her internet-based global, how do you call it, GPS. Mm-hmm. And of course found him. The voice would tell her, turn left now, go straight, turn right, and you're there. Her GPS system was down one day and she couldn't find him. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting sort of thing, that she had no conceptual idea about a very simple pattern where she was and where he was. And she did it 40 times in the last 30 days.
Wow.
It's kind of, delegating it, I say it only as a metaphor to many other things.
Right.
One of the great fears expressed in Lo and Behold is the worry that all this technology that we're so dependent on will go away, leaving us helpless. Do you feel any sense of, like, what I think of the resurgence of interest in vinyl and people raising their own chickens? Do you think people in some way are preparing for this inevitable failure?
I think there's not enough preparation for a failure of the internet. Slowly we start to comprehend, because it can be stopped or wiped out for quite some periods of time, because, let's say, massive solar flares. And that would mean we cannot do any financial transactions anymore. You cannot buy a hamburger because a cash register is connected to the internet. You cannot make any phone calls. Your electrical system would be down. You cannot pump gasoline anymore. You cannot flush your toilet anymore. You have no drinking water from your tap because it's all dead. No light, nothing, no elevator functioning. No website. And so we are very, very vulnerable. And what I think first alarm signals are out there, we have to somehow stabilize ourselves by reducing the complete and total dependency on the internet. just reduce it. I hear very often we should get rid of cash money. It would be so much easier just to do it all electronically, or even through Bitcoin, a ghost sort of a specter out there that you can't grasp. And I think that's wrong. We should rather maintain cash money because it is self-authenticating. You can tell this $100 bill is not a fake. We have clear indications it's self-authenticating. And my advice is keep a lot of small denominations, like $1, $5, $10, $20 bills. You still can buy a hamburger when the cash register is down. You still can buy the hamburger. But if you have a $100 bill, nobody can give you change. So you better have a lot of cash, stash away cash money for emergencies, and you would be able to survive, let's say, a fortnight easily. So, and the dependence on electronic money and transactions via the internet is fine and useful and very easy to handle, but it has its dangers, and you should have a fallback position.
All right, we'll make our way around. When you're shooting Lo and Behold, were there any pleasant surprises, happy accidents when you're shooting? I remember in Grizzly Man, you make a point in the narration of saying when Mr. Treadwell, he signs off, but then he keeps the camera rolling and the fox trots in there with the bears, and you say, and you make a point of that. Was there anything like that in this one?
Everything in this film was a surprise because I'm so remote from all these subjects and all these ways of thinking and utilizing the internet. So, and of course, I've seen the utmost glory of the internet, deciphering a complicated folding pattern of enzymes for research into cancer and AIDS, some very fundamental research. And the biggest supercomputers in the world could not solve it. And a mathematician and computer scientist, a very young man, puts it out on the internet for the video game community, and they respond. And their response was beautiful. Number one, over 1 million played it, and they communicated with each other, and they solved it collectively. So there's a glory in it, and robotic progress and soccer team that eventually will beat the real Brazilian team in 2050 or so. And they will eventually. I find it very, very fascinating. But of course, I also shout the very dark side, cyberbullying. And I mean, you just name it. It's horrifying what's happening. Or addiction to the internet, addiction to video games. And the addiction is as serious as there is addiction to heroin, for example.
Yeah, that's true. Contrast thematically, sort of the theme of Grizzly Man with this. It's pretty obvious dichotomy. I mean, one is sort of saying we've sort of lost touch with this the primal nature, and I mean, even Treadwell says, you know, he's before the fateful night is upset at the current technical world and with the airplane ticket or something. Explain sort of the dichotomy of theme between that and now in extension to this.
Well, Grizzly Man would be some sort of a contrast to it. However, the main tragedy of Timothy Treadwell and his girlfriend, who both were killed and eaten by a bear, was a deep misunderstanding of what constitutes wild nature. For them, it was a Disneyization of wild nature. The grizzlies are very nice, sweet teddy bears, and you can sing songs to them, and you can even hug them. Wrong. So that's a tragedy. But I think Lo and Behold is closer to a film like Cave of Forgotten Dreams, which examines the first 32,000 years dating back pictorial messages that we receive from Paleolithic people, and the awakening of the human soul and the awakening of art and music and things like this. Or, for example, a film like The Enigma of Caspar Hauser, a feature film about a young man, just adolescent, who was found in the street. It goes back to a historical case where he was kept captive in a basement without light and without ever seeing a human being or a house or a tree or clouds or hearing human language. And all of a sudden he's exposed to the real world and left as a foundling in the middle of the city of Nuremberg. And he, at a grown-up age, like an alien that has fallen down onto our planet, has to start examining what is this world all about? Who are these other people? How do they communicate? They have something like language. I have to learn it. And so it's probably a better companion piece. And subjects like that have always somehow fascinated me. So Lo and Behold is not a singular film that is somehow out of line with what I have done before.
This is a very political city, so here's one of the political questions. It seems, we're surrounded by beautiful art, museums, and monuments in the city, and so much of the emphasis is on politics, and in an election year it gets very ugly, as this one is getting.
Like almost everywhere else, let's face it.
Right.
This is not an exception.
Not an exception, but it seems like we are experiencing some sort of resurgence of very authoritarian populism, if you will, almost like in the 30s in Europe. And how do you break through as an artist to convince people to look around them and look at this wonder? You're someone who is an expert at finding untold stories and inviting people to wonder at them. How do we break through just some of the ugliness that we're seeing right now?
A filmmaker cannot really answer, and I cannot give you any redemption. However, I'm pointing out the joys of what is available for us. Conceptual thinking, how does it function? We should not lose it. And if you are reading a lot, for example, if you do not abandon reading, if you not, do not delegate it just to a few tweets that are sent out by some politicians who function basically via tweets and via populist statements. You better prepare yourself for seeing behind this. Reading, using the internet prudently, and taking whatever action you need to take in whatever position you are taking at the ballot, at least go out and vote. That's a real power that you have, and it shouldn't be underestimated how powerful every single voice is. So I do not worry too much about it, because the purely populist doesn't have much of a survival chance.
So you mentioned that you don't want documentary to be like investigative journalism, and
Others do it, and it's fine to do that, but it's not my not my quest.
Right. So when you're looking for subjects, are you like, what's sort of your thought process? Are you driven by your curiosity? Are you looking for things that'll fit within your thesis? What are you thinking about as you interview your subjects?
Well, I don't have a thesis, and otherwise I would be in academia and I would write my thesis.
For lack of a better term.
No, I know what you mean. Mm-hmm. Very often films stumble into me, and they come uninvited guests, like burglars in the night, and you wake up at 3 in the morning and there's something noise in your kitchen. And you are surprising 4 burglars in there. And while we are sitting here, I literally have 3 other films finished that are not published yet. I have yet another film which will be finished in a few weeks, and then I have yet another one. So I can never somehow catch up and be quick enough to follow up. While we are sitting here, I have 5-6 other projects that are already coming at me. So it's not that I have, I'm never planning a career now, next should be a mm-hmm. film about this or that. It's just overwhelmed by things that are coming at me, and I see some films in front of my eyes so clearly as if I were sitting in a theater. This is why I can write a screenplay so fast. I've never spent more than a week in writing a screenplay. Wow. And this is why I do not need to shoot that much. A film, and I see young filmmakers who come at me and they're exuberant. I shot 650 hours and this sort of things, and I'm editing since a year and a half, and my heart is sinking because the market itself doesn't allow this amount of time and wasting of time, energy, money to make all this kind of film. Normally the market doesn't allow it.
How much did you
And I think, know? Yeah, and since I see something so clearly, I would shoot a film like Into the Abyss about death row mm-hmm. inmate. My main person of interest was a young man. My main person of interest was a young man who was executed 8 days later in Texas. And for the entire film, which is almost 2 hours long, I shot some 8 hours of footage. Mm. And because it's such a small amount of footage, I can edit very fast. Mm. And today the editing tools, digital editing, is so fast that I can edit almost as fast as I'm thinking.
Mm. How much did you shoot for Lo and Behold, and how long was the shoot?
Shoot was something like 11 or 12 days of shooting. Mm. And the footage was more because normally I would shoot with two cameras mm-hmm. and with each person over 1 hour. Mm-hmm. So you have, I would say, 30 hours mm. of footage roughly, which is quite much in my mm-hmm. in my way of doing a film.
Well, related to that question, many years ago you said that we lived in a world where there were no adequate images.
Yeah.
We're inundated with images now. Everyone has a camera, everyone could make a movie with their iPhone. How do you feel about that?
When you look at 4,000 million people on this planet who are using their cell phones and doing photos and selfies, and so you... When you look at all these photos, you realize that there's such a thing as real high-caliber art photos, and they do not come from these 4,000 million users. And it encourages me as a filmmaker, go out, search for the other image that is not exposed on your cell phone. However, there are coming surprises from cell phones because it's so many, and all of a sudden somebody discovers surprising new terrain. But it's very rare. And I welcome what I see sometimes on the internet. Sometimes YouTube has wonderful little things that nobody had expected, nobody had on his radar. Of course we know cats can be very crazy, and a 60 seconds crazy cat video is just very delightful. But what I'm doing, and you can see it in almost all my films, is something that illuminates you in a different way. Cave of Forgotten Dreams, even in Lo and Behold, there are moments where it's not so completely new imagery, but you look into a certain depth of what constitutes us as human beings right here and right now.
Speaking of the more serious art side, not the cat videos, the serious artists, the serious filmmakers, is there, which filmmaker either that came before you or currently, both on the documentary side, filmmaker, and on the fiction side, do you think has inspired you the most?
nobody has inspired me because I hardly see any films. I watch something like 3 films a year, so much less than an average moviegoer. And
what about before you started?
I had hardly seen any films. I had seen a few very mediocre B and C movies, Zorro, Dr. Fu Manchu, things like that. And in a way, I knew I was a poet, and I would do films, and they would be much better than everything around. And my knowledge, yes, I do have some knowledge of film history, but I cannot say that anyone influenced me, since I had no knowledge cinema even existed until I was 11. I always had the feeling I'm the inventor of cinema.
Wow.
And until today, I make films as if I had invented it. And sometimes my cinematographer says, yeah, but it should have this or that look. I say, look, what do you mean by that? Yeah, like, I don't know, the Transformers or like whatever. He names some name and I say, I don't care what the look of others is. I'm the inventor of cinema. And we are inventing cinema right here and now. That's what we do. Yeah. And let's not care about style, and let's not care about look. Style and aesthetics will come in surreptitiously on their own, on its own.
I love that.
In the fiction realm, you've worked with, I mean, some of the most intense people and actors out there. Klaus Kinski, of course, but also Christian Bale, Tim Roth,
Nicolas Cage.
Nicolas Cage.
what a wonderful.
Port of Call, New Orleans is one of my favorite movies.
Michael Shannon.
Michael Shannon.
Yeah, he's the best of his generation.
I was going to ask.
No doubt. Whatever he does has something magnificent about it. He has an intensity, and he's a quintessential movie actor.
So I think
also I've never seen him on stage, but I have no doubt that he's quite good on stage as well. But in his generation, there's no one who would be better.
That was my question: is if you could work with some of these actors again, like who would Michael Shannon be the first one you'd reach out to?
I just finished a film with him, Salt and Fire. He plays. It's about a strange, mysterious hostage taking, and he's a hostage taker.
Wow. Like a thriller type film, or
no? It's actually about a woman who is taken captive and stranded in a gigantic salt flat with 2 blind boys deliberately. Mm-hmm. Only at the end we understand why this was all done by Michael Shannon, by the way.
So you mentioned that you like. Like dumb internet cat videos,
wait a moment, they're very hilarious, and I had a bad night and I want to see a cat video before I even touch my coffee in the morning, and it just makes you feel lighter.
Well, what I was going to get at is that you said that you invent cinema, but I was wondering if you're aware of yourself as sort of a pop culture phenomenon, and how that, and does that impact how you make films or interview people?
Well, I do not do interviews, I have conversations. Mm. You see, interview would be with a catalog of questions. I have nothing written on me. Mm. I just follow my curiosity. But pop culture, well, I do my work, and that's it. But I have entered into consciousness of wider pop culture by playing a villain in Jack Reacher,
right.
Or by having a guest role in The Simpsons.
Right.
I didn't even know that The Simpsons, when I was asked to join, I had to ask back, but do they talk? Do they speak? Because I'd seen The Simpsons only in newspapers as a comic strip,
mm-hmm.
and they said, "Are you pulling our legs? The Simpsons are on television since 24 years, and of course they do talk." And I said, "Can you send me a few samples on a DVD so that I can understand how cartoonish the voice has to be. Mm-hmm. They said, your voice doesn't have to be cartoonish, just keep your accent. And I said, that comes easily to me. I didn't even know that the Simpsons were talking, but in a way, it was my apotheosis in American pop culture. Mm-hmm. Or in, what else was it, Parks and Recreation. Mm-hmm. I play a cameo role and it's very, very funny. Mm-hmm. It is really funny. And the kind of humor that I have, which echoes here very visibly, is in most of, you would find this kind of humor in almost all my films. There's a lot of stuff to laugh, and it's a very unusual type of humor, sometimes a very dark humor, but you can see my humor very clearly in these short moments where I'm in the epicenter of pop culture. And that means an action film with Tom Cruise where I was paid handsomely for being frightening. And I knew I could do that. Although in my private life, I'm absolutely not that kind of a guy as you see him on screen. My wife would testify and swear to you that, to God, or anyone, that I'm a fluffy husband.
The cat video of husbands.
I have a silly question. I know that we only have a few minutes left, but you know, pertinent to the pop culture, Your films have often dealt with the relationship between man and nature, and one of the fluffiest examples of that I can think of is the Talking Animal movie. And I know you've done a number of cartoon voices. Have you ever considered making something like that?
That's a very interesting question and idea. And I think cartoon movies like Penguins of Madagascar, there's a new style, a new form out there that has really evolved beautifully. And it connects to children, and it connects to families. And that's what the appeal of it is. Yes, if I could make a real good film for children, that would be wonderful. And of course, in such a case, I would probably use the modern form of cartoons, but you really have to be in this world. And I probably would be better to write a book for children. Mm-hmm. But there are very, very good films out for children nowadays, and that's very rare because we didn't have much of that. And whoever manages really to captivate children and enjoy them in storytelling and characters is not the king of the world, but the crown prince of the world.
I guess, is she going to come in? I guess when we're done. We've all probably seen, what is it, Burden of Dreams.
Yeah.
Take me, you know, all these years later, looking back just on the craziness of that shoot. What are your thoughts of it? What are your memories?
Fitzcarraldo was not a crazy shoot. It was just haunted by complications and catastrophes, and I mean real ones, like two plane crashes, or the whole film ending up at the front in a border war between Peru and Ecuador, and my camp was attacked for 1,000 people and so, and burned down, and on. So you have to understand that whatever is being thrown at me, I have to deal with it, and there's no chance to be broken by what is happening. At the same time, I'm a very professional person who looks at what are the risks out there, and I do not need to explore my outer limits. That's a very silly idea of mountain climbers, extreme mountain climbers and others. I'm a very professionally functioning person, and you can tell because I finished the film. And I finished many other films that were different but equally complicated and haunted by problems and disasters.
Yeah. Is each movie, even the ones that aren't set back like that, you know, like pulling a steamship over a mountain, I mean, there's challenges that come up each time?
Yes, just a few weeks ago, I was filming a volcano in Indonesia, and all of a sudden, there's an eruption, and I just happened to catch it, and we had the feeling, I had a very, very professional volcanologist. We filmed this, and we decided to get out of here. And farmers who were in this forbidden zone stayed, and only a few days later, seven of them perished in another eruption of this very volcano, exactly at the place where we had our camera. So sometimes you are in certain dangers, yes, and huge glowing blobs of lava are flying at you. You see, you do not turn away and run, and you do not duck. You look up in the air and you look at the trajectory, and if it comes at you, you step out of the way. That's the right thing to do. And looking at straight in the face of danger and doing the right thing professionally, that has carried me over so many difficult films.
If you were going to do a documentary on one of your narrative films, one of your fictional films, in the same way you did Burden of Dreams of Fitzcarraldo, which one would you pick?
Well, Burden of Dreams was done by Les Blank.
If you were going to do a documentary, though, of one of your films, of revisiting...
Which I did. I did that Little Dieter Needs to Fly, and a feature film, Rescue Dawn.
Rescue Dawn was after, right?
Yes, but the concept of the feature film came first. Mm-hmm. In a way, a film that was not made yet influenced the documentary that came first. It's a very odd, sounds odd,
sense.
But it's completely what happened.
That makes sense.
But otherwise, I've done what I had to do, and I'm content that I did certain films as feature films, narrative feature films, and others only as documentaries, whereas documentaries is not so clearly distinct from my feature films anyway.
Anyone want a closing question?
Yeah.
We're good?
Yeah.
All right, cool.
Thanks so much,
sir. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome.